It's here and now. A Supreme Court without Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. For many, it's hard to imagine because it's difficult to overstate Scalia's impact on the court and on America. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic magazine and a regular on Here and Now. Derek, is there one decision that for you stands out most in your mind and tells us about Scalia's way of thinking both about America and about the law?
Hi, Lisa. I think you have to look at District of Columbia v. Heller as the most important majority opinion that he wrote. This was the first case to decide whether the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, protects individual rights to arm oneself in self-defense. And Scalia was taking on a law, the Firearms Control Regulations Act of 1975, and this law said that people couldn't buy new handguns. The language of the Second Amendment, as many people know, does not mention self-defense, but rather the necessity of a militia. But Scalia, writing for the majority, said the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess a firearm for traditionally lawful purposes such as self-defense within the home. And essentially, this was perhaps the most significant conservative opinion on the Second Amendment in the last 50 years, maybe in the last century. And the reason this was so vintage Scalia is that he used an interpretive strategy called originalism. It says, seek the original meaning of the law, or textualism. How would a reasonable person alive when the law was written read and interpret the text? And in this case, Scalia is asking, did the framers intend for the right to bear arms to exist exclusively for the purpose of a militia, which is the beginning of the Second Amendment, or were they enshrining a broader right? And what's so interesting is that even the people who disagreed, this was a close case, 5-4, even the dissenters fought the war over the Second Amendment on his turf. Everybody was asking, what did the framers intend? So, of course, Scalia, we know, is an ebullient figure, a colorful writer, but this shows his influence in dragging the whole court and dragging all of these jurists toward his framing. What do the words mean at the time they were written?
Okay, and that idea, that notion of originalism permeated many of his other decisions and dissents on the high court. Let's go through some of the most consequential cases that he decided. We can listen to him now. He's speaking now during 2000, during the major Bush versus Gore election dispute.
It could be interpreted that way by the Florida Supreme Court, I suppose. But you think it must be? Or is your point that even in close calls, we have to revisit the Florida Supreme Court's opinion?
Can you unpack that for us a little bit? Tell us what was going on in his role in the case?
Sure. Bush v. Gore is a lot more complicated than I think most people remember. So at the time, as we recall, Florida's in the middle of this chaotic recount of the 2000 election. The Bush administration says the state is using different standards of counting ballots, and those different standards violate the Equal Protection Clause. The court agrees with the Bush administration 7-2. But more controversially, the 5-4 opinion we all remember, we all debate still, is the court ruling 5-4, Scalia with the majority, saying that there's no way that the state of Florida can complete a constitutionally valid recount by December 12th. And that's considered the deadline, the so-called safe harbor deadline. And so the court, at ruling 5-4, ends the recount. They end the recount because Florida, the legislature, intended to reach this deadline by December 12th, and they think there's no way that you can have a recount that'll otherwise reach it. So essentially, you have the conservatives of the court telling the state to stop counting votes, which essentially makes Bush president. The counting of votes, I think, you know, when we look back at this case, the reason that it's so controversial is because, all right, on the one hand, you can say maybe Scalia was just going with textualism, originalism. Maybe he was being a strict constructionist of the law. But essentially, you have the five conservatives ruling that essentially the Republican presidential nominee should be president and to end the recount, which may have benefited the Democratic nominee. And so that's why it's so controversial.
We are hearing, I mean, the conversation about that particular case could go on forever. And I think Scalia himself at one point said enough. It was done, although it's still creating a lot of discussion, especially now. The Citizens United case, about political spending. This was decided in 2010. We're going to give us briefly his role there.
Sure, a little bit of background. The conservative lobbying group, Citizens United, they want to advertise a film that's anti-Hillary Clinton. There's a law that says that corporations, nonprofits, unions cannot spend money on a political message too close to an election. And the Supreme Court essentially rules, yes, actually, it can. It essentially says that corporate spending in political campaigns is speech and therefore protected by the Constitution. And once again, I think it's important to see how this goes directly to Scalia's philosophy of law, originalism. He says you can't write a law that interferes with the marketplace of ideas. You might not think it's fair for a billionaire's speech to be louder and wider spread than a poor person's speech, but the Constitution has the word fair doesn't appear in the First Amendment. It protects speech without allusion to speakers, and a corporation, he says, is just another speaker.
I think one of the reasons that so many Americans even know Antonin Scalia is not just because of his decisions on the court, his contributions to the court, but the way he pronounced his decisions.
Right.
Here he is speaking in 2012. This is during the arguments for the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. And he is expressing concerns about a so-called slippery slope. And he did so in pretty colorful terms.
Everybody has to buy food sooner or later. So you define the market as food. Therefore, everybody's in the market. Therefore, you can make people buy broccoli.
Did he make a strong impact with his words for the better or the worse? Did it kind of make the point of what he was trying to get across, or was it just a sort of a diversion?
That's such a good question. So, you know, his arguments in the same-sex marriage case were really famously rambunctious. He compared the writing in the majority opinion to a fortune cookie's aphorisms. He called the majority opinion that defended the right to same-sex marriage as interpretive jiggery-pokery, requiring, quote, somersaults of statutory interpretation. And so even people that don't agree with him still respect the color of his language. But I do think that it's worth bringing up. Would even liberals respect this colorful, curmudgeonly love of words? Would they respect it and idolize it if he were writing for the majority? If these words were spent not in dissent, but rather in depriving Americans, gay Americans, of the right to marry, I don't think they necessarily would. So one interesting thing that I think you see about Scalia is that he's adored on the right for his opinions and respected on the left for his articulation in his dissents when he was losing.
So much more to talk about. I wish we had time to talk about the right to marry and more. But thank you. We are running out of time. But thank you so much. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, speaking to us about the impact of the late Justice Antonin Scalia. Thank you, Derek.
Thank you.